Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Now everybody can hear me. So we are going to talk about Passover, as I indicated last week. I think you're going to see how this message, you know, really ties in to last week's message. Indeed, when understood, the Passover is really the foundation, you know, of everything relating to grace. I mean, it represents the epitome of grace in that way. It's grace on full display, you know, foot to the floor, all in. It's the vehicle. It's truly the legal framework by which grace is delivered. So certainly this message definitely goes hand in hand with last week, and it also goes hand in hand with the message I gave a year ago at this time, right before Passover. How many recall the message on the threshold covenant from last year? Yeah. We all know that one of the purposes of the Passover is the yearly opportunity to rededicate ourselves to the covenant that we made at baptism, the one that we have with our Messiah, with Yeshua. He's our bridegroom, and we are his betrothed bride. I truly love how the threshold covenant ties in so beautifully with the marriage covenant. Both of those subjects I have shared kind of separately, but I hope you understand that as you study each of those, they're really kind of the same thing, honestly. There's just so much to think about with each one. It is a threshold marriage covenant. The concepts of covenant and the concepts of marriage is interwoven all throughout the Bible. Indeed, we enter into the family of God through marriage. We're married into the family of God. And marriage is a covenant. And covenants were made in the time of the Hebrews, and that culture, on the threshold of the house. Do you remember this image? We all learned about how important in Hebrew culture the threshold was. They built these this way because covenants were, I don't know that I can do anything about it. It should be on in there. Covenants were routinely made at the threshold of a home. Covenants were made by taking an animal and killing that animal, and then they would take the pieces of that animal and spread them apart, and the people entering that covenant would walk between the pieces. Okay? And they would state, they would proclaim, if we break this covenant, let us be as these pieces. Right? So that's how they did it. Blood would be spilled. It would be spilled into that basin. Actually, if you remember in your Hebrew, when we talk about that basin, it is actually the word for threshold. Okay, so they would spill blood into that basin, and then the rest of the blood would go in that channel and be channeled outside the house. So, guys, they took covenants very, very seriously. They would look at our little contract pieces of paper and go, "Well, that's it." You know, I mean, they went the extra mile. And they made these covenants with their gods as well. That's where they made a covenant with their gods, right on that threshold. You might remember this image as well. Here you see a doorway of a pagan home where covenants had been made with, well, they didn't want to forget any. Right, so they just covered all the bases, right? They made a covenant with all the different, you know, pagan gods inscribed right on the doorposts and the lintel. Okay? This would have been very common in Egypt. And when we read, and we read all the time when we read about Passover, that they were to take this lamb. Well, where do you think they killed the lamb? They killed the lamb right on that threshold, and that basin of blood that they dipped the hyssop in was right there on that threshold. And then they would put it on the doorpost and the lintel. And what's it doing? It's covering up these gods that were there. You know, all through the whole kind of process of that leading up to this, what was God doing? He was really putting down all of those gods, wasn't he? All the plagues. It was really Yehovah defeating the pagan gods of Egypt, something we're going to discuss pretty soon as we get back into our Thus Saith the Lord series. We enter into this covenant the same way, through blood. But it's not our blood, we know that. But it is through a door. And what is that door? Well, we know that Yeshua is the door. And it's with His own blood, the blood of the Lamb. So I want you to think about that for a minute. That prior to the death angel coming through Egypt, the obedient Israelites had already entered into a covenant with Yehovah. They knew that's what they were doing. That was their culture, that was their custom. So it might sound strange to us that we read, okay, you know, bring this lamb in and, you know, after so many days, kill it and do this and that. And we think, our culture, but let me tell you something, guys. They understood exactly what they were doing. They knew they were making a covenant. They knew that this God that had been revealing itself through all of these plagues, they were making a covenant with that God. Right? And that God wanted His blood over all the rest of them. They needed to enter this covenant with Him and Him alone. Right? Okay. So before that death angel even came through, they had already entered this covenant. And so the blood on the doorway, the thread, the whole thing was covered with blood. What was that? It was the same thing they always thought it to be in a covenant. It was the sign of the covenant. So when the... So I have to remind you too that whenever they would make a covenant like this on the threshold, it was actually an invitation to come in. You're in covenant with me now. Now you are allowed to cross, to pass over my threshold and come into my house, right? It's a covenant relationship. It's a pass-over threshold, but it's also a pass-through into the house, inside. You're coming inside. And when we studied this, we learned that that's exactly what the Hebrew means. You know, and I don't have time today to rehearse all that Hebrew, but I want to remind you exactly what Exodus 12:23 actually says. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when He sees the blood, the sign of the covenant, on the two doorposts, that's indicating, this is me putting this in there, the parentheses, indicating there is a covenant with this house. And therefore, the one that has a covenant with this house is invited in. And so then the Lord, it says right here, the Lord will then pass over the threshold through the door. Who's coming in? The Lord. He's coming in. And then because of His presence, because He's there, He will not allow the destroyer to come in to strike you like He did with everybody else in Egypt that did not have this covenant. And you see how understanding the Hebrew and the culture there is paramount. The King James translators, they didn't have this perspective, and it makes a huge difference in how this is read and understood. And it's the basis, guys, for our marriage covenant too. Because we enter into this covenant the very same way they did, with the blood of the Lamb. And likewise, by doing this, we invite Him in to cross the threshold of our heart and come in and dwell with us. just like a bride and a groom want to have that intimacy and do life together. That is what he wants. It's a threshold covenant. It's a marriage covenant. It is a marriage. It is him coming off his throne and coming down and meeting with us and helping us and dwelling with us. I certainly don't have time to rehearse all that symbolism today of the marriage covenant, the threshold covenant. I merely wanted to just start this message and just bring to remembrance the fact that Passover is a rededication of that covenant, okay? A covenant that is only made possible by grace. It is all the work of Yeshua and Him alone. And it by that definition, it's completely undeserved on our part. Later today, when the sun goes down, we're going to celebrate the Passover. You know, for years and years, I generally heard people say, taking the Passover, not celebrating the Passover. That's no big deal. Because depending on what you're referring to, when you say Passover, both would be acceptable, wouldn't it? Both would be applicable. You would say, take the Passover. Why? Because it's a sacrifice that's going to be eaten. It was taken in, right? It's crossing. It's coming in. It's another analogy, again, of the Lamb coming into us, crossing our threshold in another way, you know? So it was taken in. And that was true for Israel. It was true in the wilderness. It was true in Yeshua's time. It's true for us today, right? In fact, when the Jews would refer to Passover, they were not referring to a holy day or to a service. They were literally referring to the sacrifice itself, referring to the lambs that were killed and eaten, of course, during the day of during the very beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So they would prepare the Passover. Okay? You prepare the Passover. You kill the Passover. You see how it's relating to the sacrifice? You eat the Passover. The Passover was synonymous with the sacrificial lamb. And Hebrew scholars will attest to this fact. It's how it's used in the Hebrew the lion's share of the time to refer to the sacrificial lamb itself. Now then, you kind of fast forward, you know, 1,000 years or even a couple hundred years or whatever. And because the Passover sacrifice was done at the beginning of the feast, it's the kind of the central thing, right? It's the beginning, okay? So you begin to see the Jews start to use the term Passover to refer to the entire 7-day festival of unleavened bread, right? And it started to encompass not just the sacrifice, but the whole festival. So by the time you get to Yeshua's time, we see the term Passover being used interchangeably, right? Sometimes you refer to it as the sacrifice itself. Sometimes it's referred to as the whole festival. And you can tell by context. Here in Mark 14, we're going to look at 3 verses here in Mark. After 2 days, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So here we see Passover and unleavened bread referred to separately. You know, for clarity, that happens sometimes too. I really included this one so that you'll notice that the Passover and the unleavened bread were both after 2 days. Okay, now we're not going to go into what that means, but the point is the Passover and the unleavened and days of unleavened bread were not a different time from each other. Groups that take the Passover ahead of the first day of unleavened bread have some tricky splaining to do on this one. Anyway, let's see the next usage. Verse 12 says, "Now on the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, His disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go to prepare that we may eat the Passover?" So here we see clearly again that the Passover was killed on the first day of unleavened bread, but also notice the reference to the Passover was that the Passover was killed. So you don't kill a day. Well, I guess maybe we do. In the vernacular nowadays, you know, if you're wasted the day, you could say you killed the day. But this is talking about killing something that is alive, actually taking a life. You certainly don't eat a day, right? You eat the Passover. So the term Passover here is directly referring to the killing of the lamb. It's referring to the sacrifice itself. Last one in Mark says, "When he goes in, say to the master of the house, the teacher says, 'Where is the guest room in which I may eat the Passover?'" So we get this same contextual meaning here. It's referring to the Passover, that is something that is eaten. It's a sacrifice. And that's how the Hebrews referred to it. But like I said, the term Passover also began to be a descriptor for the whole week because it was in fact a pivotal event. Notice here in Luke, it says his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. Well, now we don't really, you know, that's different. We're seeing the whole feast being referred to as Passover. And that's understandable to me. It is. I mean, just like I just had to explain the vernacular of killing the day, it's just kind of how it came about, because Passover was the central thing in and within the days of unleavened bread, so it began to be a descriptor of the whole entire week. And Luke makes it clear in chapter 2. "Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called the Passover." The Feast of Unleavened began just over time to be referred to that way. But Luke knew the difference. He understood that it was just maybe a vernacular thing. I don't know. Because a few verses down, he says this, "Then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed." So, it's clear that the Passover is a sacrifice that is killed on the first day of unleavened bread. Specifically, the first day. I mean, that's when it's done. But the whole thing was 7 days. And guys, it's a feast, isn't it? It's a celebration. It's a celebration. It's basically a week-long party, okay? Of a feast, you know? I mean, it was spring. The spring harvest was ready. You know, so they celebrated. It was a celebration. And so we have to have that perspective. When we come to the early believers who were comprised, you know, of lots and lots of Jews, right? They continued on with this. Now at that point, they beginning to recognize that the true lamb had come, right? And had been sacrificed. But they kept keeping the feast. You're right. They continued and they honored the Sabbaths as well. But they continued to celebrate is the point. And they would hopefully be acknowledging at the beginning of that week the true Passover lamb, Yeshua the Messiah. So much of a celebration with some of these congregations that Paul had to kind of chastise one of them, didn't he? To the church at Corinth. And we read this in 1 Corinthians 11. "Therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper, for in eating one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry and the other is drunk." You're not doing it. You're not coming for the right reason. You're not taking it right. He goes, "What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you just despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you." And we read this probably every year at the feast. And this year is no exception now. But the point is that the days of unleavened bread are a feast to the Lord. And Paul just needed to remind the church at Corinth who the Passover lamb was. that this is God in the flesh that came and suffered and died for their sakes. And it is not something to be taken flippantly like they were treating it. He's saying, look, guys, I realize you understand that Yeshua is the true, you know, and final Passover lamb, but we don't just skip over it and go directly to the party. You need to begin this feast with a recognition of him, honoring your king for what he has done. So he gave them an outline of how to do that. He goes on to describe what is done to commemorate the single biggest act of love this universe has ever seen. Continuing on here, he says, "For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Yeshua, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes.'" He wanted to make sure that they were commemorating the Passover sacrifice in the proper way. Also in the proper attitude. We read this every year too, continuing on. "Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body." Again, we should not come to Passover without reviewing this, because it is important that we come to that table with a proper respect for what had to happen for that table to be provided, right? It's a good thing. It's a good thing. We're told to examine ourselves. And I don't know about you, but it's not a lot of fun, is it? Not a lot of fun. Because when you do it, you know, it exposes a lot of weakness. Exposes a lot of sin in your flesh. And we know the whole festival is all about acknowledging sin and desiring to have it out of our lives. And I'll say this. For many, and this happens, by the time they drag themselves into the Passover service, after this time of reflection, they're depressed. Or even questioning whether they are worthy to even be there. I've known some that actually have not come to Passover because they did not believe they were worthy to be there. And it's sad. Because none of us, in that definition of the word, are worthy to be there, are we? When we define grace, we define it as unmerited pardon. If you can't be worthy to be there, or it wouldn't be grace, would it? It wouldn't be unmerited. But we are to acknowledge the sin. We are to desire to have it out of our lives and be appreciative of the sacrifice that paid the bill to even allow that to happen. And this is where it comes in, that we're to be so appreciative, in fact, that we are to celebrate that sacrifice for 7 days. We didn't come up with the Feast of Unleavened Bread. God did, right? Passover, I went through all of that to show you that Passover refers to both the sacrifice, the death of an innocent lamb, and the 7-day celebration. And this is the dichotomy that I want to talk about today, the rest of my time. When we approach this Passover, on one hand, we have this sacrifice, and we realize the depth of it, the horrible, ugly things that Yeshua had to go through that he in no way deserved. I mean, you talk about, this is the one that spoke the universe into existence. And he came to this earth, he should have been lifted up. He should have been just glorified beyond even the ability of man to do it. But what did he get? The exact opposite. He got tortured. He got shamed. He had to go through a tremendous amount of pain. And we see that. And we see what he had to go through. And then on the other hand, we have this pure joy that comes from the release of sin because of what he did. Listen to me. The reality of the Passover sacrifice proclaims and effectuates a celebration of release that comes from that work. Release from the slavery of sin and all of that bondage. Yeshua suffered and worked hard to prepare the Passover table. And it should be approached with that sort of respect that it so much deserves. But then after that, we are to rejoice in it. That's why he did it, to set us free. I struggled. I tried to come up with some sort of analogy for this. It's extremely difficult because I submit to you that there isn't any other dichotomy in this universe that could compare to it, to this gigantic gap of emotion that is involved here. But all of you know, I'm a car guy, so here it goes. I thought about, say someone that is really struggling financially, and I mean not making it. They're just going backwards every week. They're hanging on to a minimum wage job, and the car breaks down. They don't have any money to fix it. They barely got money for groceries that week. And it's their only way to work. Without that car, they lose their job. They're completely screwed, as we put it. They got no way to get it fixed. They have no way out of this mess of and by themselves. But maybe they know me. They know I got a shop. And so they come to me just pleading for help. Okay, I'll help you. I see their plight. So I go get the car. I tow it in. I assess the problems. I go down and I get all the parts with my own money. I paid the price to do it. I worked with my own hands, busted a few knuckles. I got it running. Not only did I get it running, I even looked for everything else. I did all the maintenance. I did everything to make it just perfect. Just perfect. And then I got all of my stuff out to do a full detail job and buffed it out. And it is spiffy inside and out. Like new, fully restored. So I'm all excited. I get in the car and I go to take it back to him. Now I'm going to ask you, what do you think I'm expecting? I'm expecting some joy. That's my reward. I know I ain't getting any money, but I'm expecting some joy. I'm expecting this guy to say, "Oh, Scott, thank you so much. You saved my biscuits, right? Now I can go back to work. I can, do everything I need to do because I've got my freedom back to be able to get back and forth to work. This is great." And my response would be, "Yeah, I know. I'm thrilled to help. Take care of it, right?" Yeshua gave us much to fix our car, to repair our brokenness. We're broken. And our response is to rejoice in what he has done. It's a feast. And what are we feasting on? Unleavened bread. We're feasting on his righteousness. And just like I wouldn't want that guy in my silly little analogy to go off and abuse the car, I'd want him to be appreciative of my work. I wouldn't want him to damage it anymore if possible. Yeshua is happy to clean us up. But then he says, no, go and sin no more. So during the feast, we don't eat more leaven. We don't just start consuming sin again right away just because we're cleaned up. We feast on the unleavened bread of His righteousness for a week, and we do it with what? Joy and thanksgiving. Thrilled at the work that Yeshua has done to take our sin away. Just light as a feather. How would I have felt had I gone through all that and then he just looked at it and said, oh yeah, that's thanks. It'll probably just break again. Is that the attitude we're supposed to have? No. You know, and I say that I give this analogy, but it really doesn't portray the conflict that we have when we come to Passover. It just doesn't. Because we have this tremendous pain. Because if we love Yeshua, you don't relish in it when people that you love are going through things, when they're going through pain. And so when we have this love relationship with Yeshua and we have to stop and think about what he went through, it's painful. But on the other hand, we have this tremendous blessing that affords us. And so how do we approach this table knowing what it costs while at the same time jumping for joy that of what it gives us? The only thing I could remotely come up with was how I feel when my daughters give birth. Because I know they're in pain. And I know they're hurting. And they're enduring a lot in that process. But at this very same time, I have to fight because I know it's coming and I just can't wait to hold that little baby in my arms. But the joy that brings, it's unbelievable. It's really difficult to put into words how I felt about both things. My daughters, all three of them, in pain, recovering from childbirth, and the emotional stress that causes me, but at the same time just not being able to wait for that blessing to come, to hold that little baby. I mean, that's as close as I can get, guys. There is joy in unmerited pardon, in the grace of Yeshua, but there is also an intense emotional stress knowing what that grace costs. I've thought about this for a while. It got really, really intense for me this week. Struggling to find the words to affect an appreciation for the grace of God demonstrated in the Passover sacrifice and the dichotomy of the feast where we are to celebrate and have this joy. The Bible tells us that that song was perfect, because we are unchained. We are released from bondage of sin, not carrying around its guilt, but rather giving Yeshua the joy that he deserves in seeing the work of his hands result in us being freed and happy and celebrating because of that work. In the past, I've attended Passover services where they didn't even allow people to fellowship at all, before or after. Come quiet. Don't you talk. You sit down. You keep examining yourself. You keep beating yourself up, and you make sure you're worthy. It's like attending a funeral. Actually, worse. I've attended funerals that were happier than some of them. Now, don't get me wrong, okay? I'm not saying that Paul wasn't right. You don't approach the Passover service like a meal or a party or anything else. You come to honor the one that made it happen. But afterwards, there should be inexpressible joy, a celebration, joy that should be shared and trumpeted to anybody that listened to you because you can't handle it. Right? It's got to come out. Passover is not a funeral. Let me give you a news flash. Yeshua isn't dead. He's not dead. Praise Jehovah, he's not dead. He's not dead. This is not a funeral. He's alive, and he wants to see the fruit of his labor. I know I'm getting intense, but it has been intense. It has been intense this week. We should be ready to dance in the streets for crying out loud. Come on. Now, his desire is that you stay clean. It's why we eat unleavened bread as we celebrate. There's balance in this. I'm trying to get the balance. Because we accept that we need to purge sin from our lives, but at the same time we rejoice that we're made clean from the guilt and empowered to go forward. We live in a fallen world. There's yeast in this house. It's floating in the air. Okay, it's all around us. And it's why Passover happens every year, okay? And it's going to until he returns, and probably from then on too, just to commemorate it. So his universe and his creation never forgets how we got where we were. It's just another confirmation of the fact of what we covered last week, that Yehovah's grace is new every morning. We read it last week. The Lord's mercies are not consumed, we're not consumed by them. His compassions never fail. They're new every morning, new every morning, new every year, new every minute we come to him. For many years I have covered, and you're going to see why I get this way about this. I've covered a lot of aspects over the years about Passover, the symbolism of what occurred in Egypt, how it connected to the fulfillment of the ultimate Passover lamb in Yeshua, how it connects to repentance, how we talk about our needing to come out of sin. Guys, there is so much there, and I've covered a lot of it. Probably not all of it, for sure. But most of the time, that has been directed towards our battle for sin. Our responsibility to obey, obey, obey. And it's appropriate, okay? And it's vital that we understand that. It's all but forgotten in the mainstream church. But embedded in all of that symbolism, guys, is also the joy of the release from the guilt and the bondage of sin, celebrating the marvelous work of our Creator to redeem us and rescue us. And I fear that I have missed the mark by not properly emphasizing that victory that is embedded in this. And that's why I wanted to take time today to talk about this, to get us to start thinking about these connections that we've made in the past. And at the same time that we're looking at them, we can look at them also and illuminate the joy and the freedom that is there also. Bear in mind as we do this that looking at the flip side of a coin, it doesn't erase the other side. You see? Right? It's still there. It's equally as real. But for a full understanding, we need both sides. I began touching on this last week and talking about God's grace. Even last year, I said, I bumped up against it kind of with the threshold covenant. But this year, Yehovah has really emphasized this to me. And I don't mind telling you, I sobbed, sometimes uncontrollably, putting this message together. researching it, thinking about it, praying about it. Been a tough week. It's hard on the flesh, isn't it? Every connection I could think of that I have covered over the years has this flip side of the coin. Think a minute about the Israelites in bondage in Egypt. Right? We make this as a huge connection. We know the Bible reveals that Egypt was a metaphor for sin. So symbolically, they are in bondage, right? The slaves to sin. When we resume our Thus Saith the Lord, at some point, we're going to look at each one of those plagues, and we're going to learn that those plagues were constructed by Yehovah to actually reveal the source of sin, Satan. Because that's how he was revealing himself as false gods to Egypt. So Satan is the source of sin, the source of rebellion against the Creator. So at the very outset of all of that, from the time Moses first showed up there, it is at its core a battle against sin, isn't it? Starting that at that point, from the start of the very first plague, even before the Passover service, it was a war being waged. So during this whole process in Egypt, knowing all that we've discussed in the past, let me ask you a question. Who fought the battle to overcome sin? Was it Moses, the Israelites, Yehovah, all the above? What actual force took the gods of Israel, symbols of sin and rebellion, what took him down? Moses didn't do it. He proclaimed it, but he didn't do it. The Israelites just sat back and watched and was just as shocked as the Egyptians. Obviously, it was Yehovah and him alone, not all of the above. You get it? I wanted to graphically illustrate that to get it into your head that it was not all of the above. We can never be released from sin, from the bondage and wages of sin ourselves. We have nothing to do with our release from sin. Ultimately, it's Yehovah that has and is currently, through His design, plan, and sovereign will, fighting this battle. It is His Spirit, it's His work, it's His ultimate victory in battle that redeems us and frees us from the bondage of sin. The Israelites just sat back and watched the battle as every false god in Egypt was disgraced and put down. By the time this whole thing was over, they were waltzing out of there, not only with their freedom, but with much of the wealth of Egypt. I've talked for years about that side of the coin. The fact that at the end, well, see, they needed to respond and kill that lamb. They needed to smear that blood. They needed to actually pack up and leave. They had to do these things. They had to do these things. They had to be obedient. Yes. Now think about it. Doesn't that exactly back up. What were they doing when they were doing all those things? They were accepting the covenant with Yehovah by doing those things. And isn't that exactly what we're going to do at sundown today? That was their part. Okay? You're doing the same thing. You've answered the invitation to enter the covenant, to acknowledge the battle and the war that Yeshua fought on your behalf, and He just won it. And so, yeah, that's the guy I want to hook up with. Right? That's the one I want to be in relationship with. When the Israelites saw that victory, were they sad? Oh. Yeah, look, you know, he had I had all of those gods myself, and so yeah, I'm just terrible. Did they mope around and get bummed out that they were in Egypt? No. Exodus 12, 51 says, "And it came to pass on that very same day that the Lord brought the children out of Israel, brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt." Who brought them out of Egypt? What's it say? The Lord brought them out. Yehovah brought them out. Who brings us out of sin? Ourselves? Do we do it? No. Same thing. Get a picture for this coming feast of, in your mind, of their exit. They were elated, weren't they? They were skipping and jumping and dancing out of that place, right? The only thing they were burdened down with was the weight of the gold and the silver and the wealth of Egypt. They were light as a feather, and it's a direct parallel to us. We go into Passover weighted down with the understanding of our sin and our slavery to it, but we emerge in freedom, paid for, free. And not only that, Yeshua comes and drapes us in the wealth of His righteous white robe of righteousness through His Spirit. Oh, it's solemn for sure. The firstborn of every Egyptian was dead. Dead. The price was high, to say the least. But the joy to the victor was immense. And it's no different tonight. We understand the depth of the death penalty, and we approach the table understanding that cost, but it is victory nonetheless. And if we don't celebrate that victory in our hearts and have the joy, the release from bondage that was fought for, what are we saying to Yeshua? We're expressing, well, it's all in vain. Just like I said, like taking that car back and having the guy just look at it and say, oh, no, it's nice. It's probably just going to break down again. All right? Or it looks good. It looks like it's running, but, you know, it's probably still got problems inside. Look, when Yeshua fixes something, it's fixed. This battle is won. It's over. And we really need to embrace that, to rejoice in that, to dwell in that. And, you know, right now, many of you may be running all sorts of other analogies in your head that we've discussed before, like they had to leave and they had to not turn back and there were things they had to do to obey. All true. I'm not erasing anything I've ever said about this. We are to be obedient. But I have not done a proper job of illustrating that all of those things that were done by them and by extension that we are to do are to be done within the context of the ultimate victory of Yehovah Himself, of what He has provided. Everything we do, all of our response is under the umbrella of that victory. Guys, we need to learn. The mainstream church understands victory. They just don't understand the response. Well, we tend to understand the response, but we erroneously believe that we have something to do with the victory. Well, we don't. I understand that breaks down a little bit, but please give me some grace and realize that I'm trying to find words to illustrate a balance. Just like that coin, you can only see one side of a coin at a time, right? It's hard to describe both sides at the same time, okay? But just because you're talking about this side and you're looking at that, this side's still there. And I want us to start thinking about the symbolism of sin, the battle with sin, the putting it out of our lives like we do the leaven, the Passover sacrifice in Egypt that foreshadowed the work of Yeshua on the stake, all of the things that we've discussed over the years, and put it all in the context with the fact that it's God's work. His victory that we can rejoice in and walk in as incredibly wealthy participants. See, we got that wealth coming out of Egypt. That wealth is the Spirit of Yeshua and His righteousness coming in us, crossing that threshold. When you come to the table tonight, you'll obviously come in a solemn manner. You'll come with your knowledge of your sin. I get it. I will too. The message is, don't leave with it. Don't leave with it. Or you reject what Yeshua has won for you. He's won. You've won. You're wiped clean. You are released from the bondage of the sin. Okay? Accept it. Guys, don't take my word for this. I want you to hear in your heart what Yeshua Himself said. Matthew 11, verse 28 says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Yeshua fought for you to release you from the bondage and the burden, the guilt of sin. As you come away from the service tonight, accept it. Bask in the joy of it. To the point that when you feel that, you never want to lose it. Now that's motivation. It's when you're clean and you, man, it's wonderful. God's love, His mercy and grace wash over us, and it's fantastic. And that becomes the motive. You want to stay that way. You don't want that messed up. And that's why we resist sin. That's why we want to learn what sin is. That's why we want to walk that way. That's why we reach out to Yeshua and desire His Spirit to lead and guide us, because we want to stay that way. Because that's who we're in covenant with. You can't earn any of it. But once you have it, you don't want to let go of it, right? That's what we're talking about. To feast on the joy of righteousness. And God said, let me give you a symbol for that. Eat unleavened bread all week. Or keep reminding yourself. See, all that teaching, all that teaching about overcoming sin and all of this without this flip side, you know what it does? It just puts more burden on you. It's just more burden. It's the exact opposite of what Yeshua wants. He wants us to have that inexpressible joy of knowing what it's like to be clean and stay there. His yoke is easy. His burden is light. Because why? Because He's taken the guilt of sin off of us with His work. His work. You're clean and spotless. See, the perspective is that we don't go forward trying to get rid of the burden of sin. No. Because we can't do that. It's already done. We just have to accept it. We have the complete release of it. And by knowing that state, again, our desire becomes wanting to dwell there, to walk in it. That's our battle. Just kind of moving through life. You know, walking with Yeshua and following His Spirit to avoid more sin. So that, you know, He doesn't have to just keep crucifying Himself. Do you want that? No, of course you don't. We can have Him right there to take victory for us over and over again. That's the picture of the days of unleavened bread. Avoiding sin, leaven, but also consuming the unleavened bread, which is what? The bread of life, Yeshua's Spirit, Him Himself. But guys, the burden is gone. The guilt is wiped away. The wages of sin is paid. That battle is not ours. And was never ours. He waged it all by Himself. You just need to accept it and dwell in it. You see how someone can rightfully stand up in a mainstream church and say it's all about Christ? Just accept Him as your Savior? I hope so. You should be able to hear that as truth, because it's true on that side of the coin. See? On that side of the coin. Because that side of the coin is just as real as the other one. We get to rehearse that acceptance in just a few short hours. We get to invite Yeshua once again across the threshold of our lives. And it's why I wanted to quickly rehearse those basics of the threshold covenant. The death angel passing over the houses with the blood, because Yehovah had already passed through into the houses. You get that? See, when we're in covenant with Yeshua, and He's passed over the threshold of our heart, and He's dwelling in us, and we abide in that, and we connect with that, Satan can't touch us. He has to pass over. The darkness can't dwell with light, can it? It's a beautiful picture. Now, why can't He touch us? Because of supplication. God has come off His throne, and He's passed over our threshold into our hearts to help us. It's exactly what we saw last Sabbath with the Hebrew word picture of God coming off that throne, passing over our threshold to help us, to dwell with us. That's the covenant. That's what God establishes with us, with His blood. Is anybody here excited for tonight? Come on. I know we're humbled. You know, you do. It is humbling that, you know, somebody had to go through what he had to go through because of me personally. But we also seriously look forward to that cleansing power of His blood. Look what John said. The next day, we'll close here. John saw Yeshua coming towards him, and he said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." We always look at this and we use it as a scripture to just show that, yes, that Yeshua was the Lamb. But what's He do? He takes away the sin of the world. There it is, guys. It's right in front of you. The question is, do you believe it? Are you willing to have Yeshua take away your sin? Come to that table tonight with your guilt and sin. Bring it. Bring as much as you can muster, okay? It ain't, you can't bring a heavy enough load that Yeshua can't handle. Bring it. But literally, for heaven's sake, don't leave it there. Don't take it with you. Don't pick it back up, or you miss the whole point. The Lamb of God suffered greatly to take the burden of sin from you. Don't listen to Satan and pick it back up. You're going to be spotless. And that will infuse a desire to live in that victory, to continue in that state as much as possible. And we do that by bringing in the unleavened bread of Yeshua's Spirit and dwelling there. Dwelling with the one that is willing to come off His throne to help us. You know, that picture of the greater one coming down to help the inferior one. It's exactly what Yeshua did. God Himself came off the throne to help us, to fight the battle we could not win. And it's illustrated in just two scriptures, last ones. John 1:1 says, "In the beginning was the Word," was Yeshua, "and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." So what do we know? That Yeshua is God, fully established. So let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Lay it aside. Lay that weight aside, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. looking unto Yeshua, the author and finisher of our faith, who, yeah, if I could go, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Guys, don't withhold the joy that Yeshua deserves for his work. He emptied himself of his divinity. He stepped off the throne. He lowered himself and took on flesh to help us. For what reason? For the joy of seeing his children being able to lay aside the weight of the guilt of sin. So honor him and let it go. Because he is the author and finisher of our faith. Trust that. Let him cross your threshold. Be refreshed. Be happy. Celebrate. That's the joy that Yeshua worked for. It's incredible the desire that he has for us to be free, happy, and clean. Amen?
Amen.
Amen.